It takes about half a second to turn something we think into something we say. Scientists have been studying just what happens in our brains during that half second, and there's a lot of activity found in the part of the brain that's the subject of our next report. It's a part of the brain called Broca's area. Now, after more than a century of effort, scientists have found some clues to what happens there. NPR's John Hamilton has the story.
A lot of what we know about how speech works in the brain comes from a French doctor in the 19th century. His name was Pierre-Paul Broca.
He had two patients, and they both had a very strange pattern of mental problems.
Ned Sahin is a researcher at UC San Diego and Harvard University. Sahin has spent a lot of time pondering Dr. Broca and his two famous patients.
They were aware of their situations. They could see and hear. They can even understand what people were asking them, but they couldn't answer back.
Broca suspected brain damage, so after his patients died, he took a look.
The patients both had holes in the brain, and they were in roughly the same area. And so that area became known as Broca's area.
It lies just beneath your left temple. Somehow, this part of the brain helps us speak. But scientists haven't learned much more than that, despite lots of autopsies and studies using high-tech brain scans. What they needed was a way to directly monitor the cells in Broca's area in real time. Sahin says you can do that, but you have to put wires into a person's brain.
And humans don't like wires in their head.
So Broca's area remained a mystery, until Sahin and a team of researchers came across three very cooperative patients with epilepsy. All three were going to get surgery to remove some of the brain tissue causing their seizures. To plan that surgery, doctors had put dozens of electrodes in their brains. Sahin says the three patients agreed to play a sort of word game on a computer while they were wired up but still conscious.
So, for instance, they might see the word walk and then the sentence frame, every day they with a blank, or yesterday they with a blank. And the job was to say the form of the word that was correct for that blank.
Meanwhile, the scientists monitored what was happening in Broca's area and precisely when it happened. Sahin says at 200 milliseconds, that's 0.2 of a second after seeing the words, a spike in brain activity suggested they were figuring out what the words meant.
At 320 milliseconds, we saw evidence of grammatical processing. And then at 450 milliseconds, we saw processing for the sound form of the word, queuing up what exactly to say and getting ready to say it.
The results show that Broca's area is involved in several major processes related to speech. Nina Dronkers works at the VA's Northern California healthcare system and treats patients who have language problems caused by brain damage. She says the new study supports what a lot of researchers already suspected.
More and more, we're thinking of Broca's area as a region that can do many different things. And the nice thing about the study is that it shows that even these different functions can emerge within an extremely short time frame.
Dronkers is also intrigued by the study's finding that brain cells working on grammar, for example, seem to be in almost the same place as cells working on comprehension or speech production.
So they might serve one function at one point in time and another function at another point in time.
Scientists think Broca's area probably isn't limited to speech. It may help us process music as well. The new study appears in the journal Science. John Hamilton, NPR News.
A book that generations of children have loved has finally arrived in movie theaters as a film. It's Where the Wild Things Are, a much-anticipated release, although film critic Kenneth Turan says it has not been worth the wait.
It's painful to say this, but Maurice Sendak's beloved Where the Wild Things Are has been turned into a self-indulgent cinematic misfire that neither parents nor children are going to like. Sendak's story uses only 10 sentences and doesn't provide a lot of plot. To fill in those spaces, Wild Things expands on the sullen brattiness of 9-year-old Max. We first meet him throwing tantrums left and right. Sure, those qualities are present in the book, but blowing them up this way turns the film into a celebration of some of the most childish aspects of being a child. Then Max bites his mother. Hard. Terrified at the mess he's gotten himself into, Max runs away and magically ends up on an island where the wild things live.
This is our family. I hope you can see how excited they are to have a king.
These creatures look great, kind of like hipster versions of NFL team mascots. But once they open their mouths, things go downhill fast.
Ah!
What are you thinking?
Syndax creatures have been turned into neurotic adults with dysfunctional relationships.
Douglas, no, 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 stop. That's not the way I want you to do it. Oh, sorry.
To hear them talk among themselves is to feel like you've stumbled onto a group therapy session involving unfunny refugees from an alternate universe Woody Allen movie. Sometimes you are better off with 10 sentences than tens of millions of Hollywood dollars. And Where the Wild Things Are is one of those times.
Ken Turan reviews movies for Morning Edition and the Los Angeles Times. You can watch clips from the film and read reviews of other movies out this weekend by going to NPR.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. The late Senator Edward Kennedy wanted to promote volunteer service, and he sponsored a law called the Serve America Act, which took effect in the first of the month. The law expands programs like the Silicon Valley Encore Initiative, which is a Bay Area pilot project that pairs retired corporate big leaguers with nonprofits that could use their expertise. Rachel Miro of member station KQED in San Francisco has more.
After 20 successful years at Hewlett-Packard, Leslie Louie left in her mid-40s. She wanted to do some good in the world. The question was, what exactly?
I entered the wild world of Craigslist, and I would do a lot of volunteer work. I literally stuffed envelopes.
This is a former VP of sales and marketing talking for a $15 billion business unit at HP. Louie can stuff envelopes, but she can also offer something a lot of envelope stuffers can't.
In between being a volunteer and sitting on the board, which is a little bit more removed, is a huge field of contribution.
Then Louie got a call from Hewlett-Packard. The tech giant was launching a pilot program with Civic Ventures, a San Francisco nonprofit focused on getting baby boomers nearing retirement to launch into encore careers, careers with a social purpose. Yvonne Hunt is HP's VP of Social Investment.
Typically the answer is, well, I'd like to go into the nonprofit sector, but I don't know how to do it.
Hunt says a lot of nonprofits could use the kind of expertise cultivated in private industry.
Human resources, IT, marketing.
The key is finding a way to connect corporate talent with nonprofit need, which is the idea behind the Encore Fellowships HP set up with Civic Ventures.
This is just a nice, innovative model that allows those two worlds to merge.
Civic Ventures interviewed Louie to assess her skills and interests, then offered her a short list of likely nonprofits. Soon, she and another HP alum headed off to Partners in School Innovation, a 30-employee, $3.5 million organization focused on ground-level reform at urban public schools. CEO Derek Mitchell says the nonprofit's clients are school administrators and teachers.
We really help them refine lesson plans, look at the data after they applied that new lesson and asked the question of how could it have gone better.
The Encore Fellows did something similar for Partners. Over the course of 1 year, they developed a performance management database. Louie explains.
What data, what metrics, what evidence do we have of the actual impact they're having at different levels, at the school-wide level, at the grade level, and at the student level?
When it became clear the computers at Partners weren't up to the task, the Encore Fellows got HP to donate new equipment. Winning over the staff at the nonprofit was not so easy.
In my first presentation, I think I used the P word, profit, quite a few times, and it just fell so awfully. I hate to even remember that.
The awkwardness didn't last. Within 4 months, Louie was asked to serve as acting CEO during the leadership transition that brought in Derek Mitchell.
I don't think I would have gotten here with Craigslist. No, and I worked for some fabulous organizations as a volunteer. But no, I don't think you can just walk in and convince a CEO that you can lead the reorganization of the whole institution to be results-driven. They probably throw you out. Yet that was the trust that was placed in us because of this program.
It's worth noting the Encore Fellows don't work for free. Hewlett-Packard chips in $12,500 a year per fellow, as do participating nonprofits. Mitchell says putting a price tag and a deadline on the partnership ensures that the fellow and the nonprofit are focused on making the most of each other. Would he do this kind of thing again?
In a heartbeat.
The Serve America Act calls for 10 one-year Encore Fellowships in each state, with federal funding to help make it happen. For NPR News, I'm Rachel Miro in San Francisco.
Fans of Julie Andrews can hear her voice once more. That almost perfect singing voice was damaged in surgery, yet her talent for music shines through on a CD that accompanies a new collection of children's poetry.
Quinquereme of Nineveh from distant Ophir, rowing home to haven in sunny Palestine, with a cargo of ivory and apes and peacocks, sandalwood, cedarwood, and sweet white wine.
Julie Andrews put together this collection of poems, songs, and lullabies with her daughter, Emma Walton Hamilton. And as Andrews told NPR's Lynn Neary, poetry has long played an important role in her family.
When Julie Andrews and her daughter started to think about which poems to include in this collection, a couple of obvious ones came to mind, Sea Fever and Cargoes by John Masefield, because they were among the first poems Andrews had memorized as a child. And then there was
A.A. Milne's The King's Breakfast, which is that charming poem, The King Asked the Queen and the Queen Asked the Dairymaid. Could we have some butter for the royal slice of bread? And of course, it's a wonderful poem to read to children. That had to be in the book. And so it was joint favorites, personal favorites. Of course, once we started looking, we discovered 100 new favorites.
This one is a favorite from both of our childhoods.
So we're going to read it together. And it's called The King's Breakfast by A.A. Milne. I'll start. The king asked the queen, and the queen asked the dairymaid,
could we have some butter for the royal slice of bread?
The queen asked the dairymaid. The dairymaid said,
certainly, I'll go and tell the cow now before she goes to bed.
The dairymaid, she curtsied and went and told the Alderney,
don't forget the butter for the royal slice of bread.
Andrews and Walton Hamilton even included a few of their own poems, as well as some by Andrews' father and grandfather. Andrews says poetry has always been a family affair. Her own parents were divorced, but when she visited her dad, he would always read poetry to her.
He actually loved to commit poems to memory because he felt that on a walk, if he needed to talk to himself or never be lonely or flex his brain, he could recite a poem. And he had many committed to memory.
And your father's favorite poem is Loveliest of Trees, which, of course, is included in this book. Do you have it memorized by any chance?
Not all of it, but you can prompt me. It's by A.E. Housman.
Right.
And it is one of my favorites, too. Loveliest of Trees. The cherry now is hung with bloom along the bough, and goes about the woodland ride wearing white for Eastertide. And here's where I get a little lost. Anyway, eventually it ends up by saying, about the woodlands I will go to see the cherry hung with snow.
The collection also includes the lyrics of songwriters like Johnny Mercer, Stephen Sondheim, and Rodgers and Hammerstein.
For me, whenever I choose a song to sing, it's about the lyric first. You'd think, of course, it's about the melody, that's a given. But really, I'm no good at singing a song unless it has a good lyric. I mean, my favorite things from The Sound of Music is really a poem.
Raindrops on roses and whiskers on kittens, bright copper kettles and warm woolen mittens, brown paper packages tied up with strings. These are a few of my favorite things.
Then there's a glorious lyric by Ira Gershwin to a song called My Ship. And that is really, I think it's almost one of my favorite songs, but it is because the words are so beautiful.
My ship has sails that are made of silk. The decks are trimmed with gold.
The loss of her singing voice more than 10 years ago was devastating for Andrews, but since then she's become famous with a whole new generation, taking on parts in films like The Princess Diaries and Shrek 2 and 3. And while nothing will ever replace her singing, Andrews says reading poetry out loud comes close.
It certainly gives me a satisfaction, and to bring my own take to the reading of each poem is great fun. But, yeah, I do hear the music, and there's rhythms and and movement and words that are important. It's great fun to read them.
Andrews hopes this collection of favorite poems, family poems, and memorable lyrics will lead others to discover the joy of reading aloud to children. Poetry may seem intimidating, she says, but mostly it's a way to connect with the people you love. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
And you can hear Julie Andrews read some of her favorite poems on our website, npr.org.
You're listening to Science Friday from NPR News. I am Ira Flatow. Up next, the latest on a mysterious illness called chronic fatigue syndrome. Researchers have been studying people who've been diagnosed with it, trying to figure out what might be causing their symptoms, which range from joint pain, debilitating fatigue, and inflammation. A team of researchers reports that they've hit on something. Out of 101 people diagnosed with chronic fatigue, 67% of them had a specific virus in their blood, a virus called XMRV, and just 4% or so of healthy volunteers had the virus in their blood. Scientists have known about the virus for a while. It's been implicated in other diseases. Joining me now to talk more about this work published in the journal Science is John Coffin, professor of molecular biology and microbiology at Tufts University in Boston. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Coffin.
Good afternoon, Ira. Thank you.
So this is pretty good, a pretty good indication, a pretty good connection.
For a first report, it's very good. In fact, there's still a lot of work to be done to firmly establish a causal relationship between the virus and the disease, but it's a very, very interesting first step.
Well, this would also vindicate a lot of people who have chronic fatigue syndrome, who have, you know, been abused by people who think it's all in your head, you've got something else, it's just a syndrome, there's no real cause to it, things like that.
I would imagine that's the case, yes.
Mm-hmm. And so how did you go about, what was your motivation for looking for this viral connection?
I have to make one thing very clear right here. The work we're discussing was not mine. Mm-hmm. It was done by other groups. I'm a very interested observer and chronicler of their work, mm-hmm. and I had worked on this virus many years ago when we thought it was just a mouse virus.
Mm-hmm.
The people that did work on it, my understanding is that their motivation was based on a correlation that had been previously reported, this virus and a certain specific mutation in individuals with prostate cancer in a gene called RNase L.
Mm-hmm. How many more people would need to be studied, do you think? And you need a much larger study to make a better, more cementable?
Well, we certainly need a much larger study, but that's absolutely called for. We don't know very much about the association except for the 101 people you just mentioned. And my understanding is there's over 1 million people diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome or suspected to have chronic fatigue syndrome in the United States alone.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible there are multiple diseases that have very similar symptoms? And there's all kinds of things that are possible here that we just haven't sorted out yet.
Is it possible that the virus is a red herring in the way? And I mean by that people with chronic fatigue may have some other problem that leaves them susceptible to getting this virus.
That's entirely possible, and this all needs to be sorted out, and I think it will be sorted out very quickly, probably within the next few months.
Where do you find the virus in the body?
The virus, so far, has been found in white blood cells, principally. And it's been possible by the groups who are doing this to actually isolate and grow virus from those cells and to grow it in new cells of the same type from healthy donors.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't know. It's been isolated from those cells because those are, in a sense, the easiest cells to look at. You can just take some blood and get them out of it. We don't know what other cells it is and isn't in infected individuals at this point.
Mm-hmm. And the virus has been implicated in other diseases.
There's an implication of prostate cancer. There was a paper that appeared about a month or so ago providing a somewhat less striking, about a 25% incidence of the virus in cases of prostate cancer.
Mm-hmm. And where do we know where it comes from?
Well, it almost has to come from mice. It's very, very closely related to what's called an endogenous virus of mice. An endogenous virus is a retrovirus that's inherited in the DNA, in the germline of its host. And we have been studying, this is a virus we've been studying mm-hmm. for over 25 years now in mice, never thinking that it might, in fact, also be in humans.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Also, you can tweet us at SciFry. In the 101 patients, or in the total study of all the patients, were they split equally among different ages, or did you find that the virus was in older or younger people, or certain people of certain age?
I don't believe, again, it wasn't my study. Mm-hmm. My understanding is there wasn't any obvious connection of that sort, but I don't know that for sure, I have to admit.
Is there any way to get rid of this virus once it's in your
Probably
bloodstream?
Probably not. A retrovirus, like HIV, is also a retrovirus, and there's no way to get rid of HIV that we know of, despite the fact that we've tried very, very hard over many years to do so. HIV infection can be suppressed, and people can be relieved of the symptoms of the disease for very long periods of time, but nobody, as far as we know, has ever really been proven to be cured of the infection, and I suspect the same thing would prove to be true of this virus as well.
Mm-hmm. You write in an article, or I'm going to quote from an article from Science Express, that another notable feature of XMRV is that the frequency of infection in non-disease controls is remarkably high, about 4%.
Right.
In both normal individuals from the same geographic region as infected patients. It would mean that perhaps, it says, 10 million people in the U.S. and hundreds of millions worldwide are infected with this virus.
That's the implication. That's, again, a very initial study on just a few people, and one needs to get a much larger sample and some real demographics and so on to establish those numbers. But that's certainly what that would imply as we look at the numbers. If we take those numbers at face value right now, mm-hmm. that would be about 10 times the number of people in the United States who are infected with HIV, for mm-hmm. example. Mm-hmm.
Are you being inundated with people, or do you feel that people are going to want to be tested now?
I've gotten a few emails. I should make it very clear that there are no clinically approved diagnostic tests based on this at present, and it will be some time before such tests are available. Any tests that are being done now are being done purely with research tools, most of which were originally developed to study the mouse virus, as I was talking about.
Mm-hmm. And we don't know how the virus is spread.
We have no idea how the virus is spread right now.
But we know that it's in mice.
It is in mice. All mice carry some virus like it in their DNA, and some. At least in laboratory mice, some express it as infectious virus. And it almost certainly, as I said, came from mice originally. How it mm-hmm. got from mice to humans, again, we have no idea yet.
Let me get a phone call or two in here. Let's go to Bobby in San Francisco. Hi, Bobby.
Hi. Really enjoy your program, Ira.
Thank you.
I've had chronic fatigue syndrome now since my 40s. I'm 72. And I wonder if the individual you're talking to has heard of the work of Dr. Nancy Klimas, K-L-I-M-A-S, or the recent studies which found over 350 genetic expression anomalies in chronic fatigue patient syndromes. Oh, pardon me if I'm confused a little bit there.
Okay.
I haven't heard of that work specifically, no. It certainly wouldn't surprise me to hear that there's a lot of differences in gene expression in mm-hmm. patients.
The fact that this is a retrovirus, what does that say to you?
The fact that it's a retrovirus means it's a virus that replicates in a very specific way by converting its genome RNA to DNA and causing that DNA to be integrated in with the cellular genome to become essentially a normal cellular gene, and then that gene directs the production of more virus. There are many different types of retroviruses. HIV is one. There's a virus called human T-cell leukemia virus, which is responsible for some cases of leukemia and lymphoma in humans. Mm-hmm. And then there's a very large number of other viruses in this general group.
Can you explain the nomenclature XMRV to describe this?
X comes from xenotropic. It's a slightly confusing designation. What it means is that the virus is found as an endogenous virus, meaning it's in the germline of its host, in this case mice, but if you take the virus out of the germline and take the DNA out and make virus out of it, that virus will not infect mice, and therefore, but it will infect humans and many other species of animals but not mice. And the reason for that is that mice, after the virus got into the germline of mice, after which is probably around a million years ago or so, the mice became resistant to it by accumulating a mutation, which made them no longer able to be infected by that virus. Mm-hmm.
So it worked its way into the human population?
And somehow it's worked its way into the human population.
Mm-hmm. So we think it's much more prevalent than we might think otherwise?
Well, the estimated prevalence right now is that 4% number that we were discussing earlier. Whether there's more than that, how real that number is, yeah, and so on, we just have to find out. Good studies have to be done to establish that.
All right, Dr. Coffin, I want to thank you for taking time to be with us.
You're very welcome.
Good luck to you. John Coffin, professor of molecular biology and microbiology at Tufts University in Boston and author of A New Virus for Old Diseases. It's a Science Express paper.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Mexico has deployed its navy to several beaches along the Pacific coast, but the move's got nothing to do with fighting drug cartels or protecting tourists. They're protecting an endangered sea turtle. Olive Ridley turtles were once harvested to the brink of extinction. But as NPR's Jason Bobian reports, the Mexican government has orchestrated a comeback.
This time of year, along a solitary sandy beach in southern Oaxaca, turtles bob in the waves just offshore. And then, based on some signal that's not entirely clear to scientists, the females storm the beach. Well, they sort of waddle out of the surf on their flippers, but they come ashore by the thousands. Erica Peralta Buendia, a biologist with the Mexican government, is standing amid the mass of female turtles.
Practically, la playa se llena.
Practically the whole beach is full, she says. It's 3 or 4 kilometers full of turtles, one right next to another. This is La Escobilla, one of the most important nesting grounds in the world for the olive ridley. The females are gray, weigh about 100 pounds, and their shells are about the size of a tire on a Honda Civic. Prior to 1990, this beach was a slaughter ground for the olive ridley. Sea turtles can't retract their heads into their shells. People would bludgeon them to death and then haul them to Mexico's largest turtle processing plant just up the coast.
In 1990,
Mexico declared a total ban on killing sea turtles, Peralta says. No one can harvest the turtles or their products. Prior to this, turtle byproducts, the meat, the shells, the skins, the eggs, were the second largest industry for this impoverished region after shrimp. The slaughterhouse used to employ 200 people at the height of the season, but while it was offering jobs, it was decimating the sea turtle population. The Mexican government shut down the plant in 1990 and replaced it with an aquarium called the Mexican Turtle Center.
This is the peak of the season. Yes, we are going probably 100,000 turtles in 3 or 4 days.
Marta Harfush, a biologist at the center, says sea turtles are extremely vulnerable for several reasons. First, they only nest in significant numbers on a few beaches in Mexico, Costa Rica, and India. Second, the turtles are only on land when they're born and when they lay their eggs. Consequently, they're sitting ducks on the beach. Vultures pluck the soft-shelled babies out of the sand soon after they hatch, and a beetle has been destroying their eggshells. And people still covet their meat and eggs. Harfush says turtle fat is sold as a cure for the common cold. Turtle meat is still a traditional meal at some weddings, and their eggs are supposed to have sexual powers.
They use in bars or restaurants for not for food. It's a complement of the beer. That's why, and they say that it's aphrodisiac. That's why many people sell them.
She says the temperature on the beach can also dramatically affect the turtle population. If the sand during the third week of incubation is 30 degrees centigrade, half the hatchlings will be female and half will be male. But if the average temperature rises 2 degrees during that period, all the babies will be females, she says. And if it falls 2 degrees, all the babies will be males. Prior to 1950, an estimated 10 million olive ridley turtles nested each year on Mexico's southern coast. By 1988, just before Mexico banned their harvest, the population had dropped to just 40,000. The National Marine Fisheries Service in the U.S. still categorizes the olive ridleys that breed in the Pacific as endangered, but Harfush says they've rebounded significantly. Now just shy of 1 million olive ridleys nest each year, primarily on three beaches in Oaxaca. Jason Beaubien, NPR News.